Welcome to the Breakpoint Show, the podcast dedicated to analyzing the tennis Netflix docuseries Breakpoint, episode by episode. I am Gil Gross with Alex Gruskin, and this is the final episode of season two. It is season two, episode six, Becoming the One. In this case, the one is the American to win the U.S. Open. I think that's the one, Gruskin, fair to say?
I think it's the first American to win a major. Yes, certainly in New York being the spotlight event, but of this new generation. And it is funny how quickly we've done Sonia Kenin erasure, who is still 25 years old, won the 2020 Australian Open. But certainly in the post-Serena, post-Andy Roddick landscape, yeah, John Isner was the best American for the long time, for a very long time. But we haven't had a clear-cut American slam contender at every major in quite some time. Kenin had a moment. Stevens and Keys had moments. We never really had that consistent presence on the men's side. I think what this episode is trying to allude to is who is going to be that player who amongst this next generation, which has been a theme in multiple episodes now of this season, who amongst this next generation of Americans is going to step up and, as they allude to, become the one. It's certainly a fascinating storyline to follow.
So they were back to Taylor, they were back to Tommy, they were back to Francis, and those guys, what was it, episode three, I think, of this season, where it was kind of the, you know, we're going to key in and focus on those three Americans. But what ended up happening at the 2023 U.S. Open is, of course, Ben Shelton doesn't just beat one of them, he beats two of them, of that trio, and Fritz falls to Djokovic. This was one of the most blatant examples that I can remember of the tennis didn't go to Netflix's plan. Like, they couldn't write the script on this one.
But I love how the episode also reflected that. You think Tommy, Taylor, Francis are going to be the story. And then it's like, well, actually, it's Ben Shelton who has to be the story, who we now have to introduce and have to talk a little bit about here, have to get in this interview booth, because this was a moment for the young American. And I think this episode actually perfectly captured the ethos of that U.S. Open. Those three guys and four Americans overall making the round of 16 was a huge deal in the tennis world. And this storyline reflected that. And so the fact that it was Ben, the least acclaimed of the group, that emerged from them all and beat two along the way, that was a stunning moment. And that he has the weapons and has the personality to carry a moment like that only added to the fun for everyone. But that's what I loved about this episode. I also loved the opening title sequence, to your point, which not only established the American tennis storyline so well with input from Jim Courier, input from all of the players, but I love that how they check in on Taylor, Tommy, and Francis. It's a perfect reflection of each of their personalities. You have Tiafoe, now the center of attention. He's at the New York party. He's talking with celebrities. Every person wants to come up and get some attention from Francis. You have Tommy enjoying life. He's at a beautiful house, looks like in the Hamptons. He's enjoying French toast. He's goofing around with his team, enjoying the spoils of his success. And then you have Taylor, who's just only thinking about tennis always and is upset about a result, not enjoying a party that's in his honor, but thinking, man, I have to make the quarterfinals of this event. You know, they make light of the helicopter incident from season one, which was a great callback where Taylor rode a helicopter into the U.S. Open. And it's funny, him and Francis on the training table in this episode making fun of that as Tommy rides in on the helicopter. Just like, it was an excellent portrayal of where these three players have come, and gets back to something I had pointed out through these episodes. It's really nice that this season gave themselves the opportunity to follow up on an earlier storyline. And yeah, the US Open broke perfectly for them to do so, and they had other plot points they could pick from early in the season, but it was really well done. Like, I really enjoyed this as a finishing point for this season. They wrapped up all the storylines nicely.
I think the men's side worked better than the women's side in the Coco story, which we can kind of get into. And I think the difference was,
you promised me Brad Gilbert. No Brad Gilbert.
I didn't promise you Brad Gilbert, but I did assume. I assumed we were going to get the Coco story And at the end of the day, we got the images and the moments, yeah, which were really cool in their own right. And like, look, I can watch Coco Gauff winning that match point a million times and it will never get old. The emotion on her face, her dad crying, the post-match kind of address to Ash, like, it was such a monumental and electric moment that, I mean, I don't know why. Gruskin, do you feel the same way? Like, we have, I think, a little bit of journalistic detachment from results. Like, we're not watching matches, rooting really hard for players all the time, like a lot of fans are. But in terms of just what hits me emotionally, Gauff winning that US Open, for some reason, like, goes a little bit deeper on the emotions level than kind of any other major winning moment in recent history for me.
Absolutely. It's to the episode's point. And this, much like episode five, it was a little bit superficial, right? And it hurt that Coco wasn't participating. So you got interview clips that people like you and I had heard from before. And you didn't get anything new, out of this episode. But absolutely. Like, as I was watching this, I couldn't help myself but think, like, man, it would be so nice to have that feeling, to fall to your knees, to look up. And for me, I was thinking, if I could just look at my older brother and be like, dude, can you believe this? And he kind of looks back and he's like, no, man, that is the sensation she got in front of 40,000 people roaring for her on Arthur Ashe. Just what an incredible moment for someone who, again, you can see just emerging into a superstar, whether it's her as a speaker at a WTA 50-year anniversary event, whether it's her joking around with Shelton and Tiafo in the locker room, a really fun scene that kind of shows, like, hey, Coco is down to earth. Like, she will clown around with you. She can goof around and talk trash with the best of them. And then she has this crowning moment where it kind of all comes together and you just wonder, okay, what's the future going to be like for her? I really hope there's a season three of this show. And I know that's something we'll talk about at the end, but it kind of sets up perfectly for, like, all right, where does Coco go next? Tune into season three to find out.
Yeah. The only thing is, I guess we can talk about this now. So the difference, first of all, I'll just lay this out. The difference was, it seems like with Shelton, they realized midway through the tournament, okay, we need to now get some cameras on him. Yeah. We need to see if we can get him in this. And I'm sure they went to his, I think the way it works, they go to his agent and they drum up a contract real quick, and they can make, they have that flexibility to do things. I'll call it a pivot, midway through. Mm-hmm. And for Coco, that didn't happen, but I would imagine Gauff is such an obvious get, such an obvious ask, that it's not as if, I don't think it's as if, you know, they opted not to be with Coco and to get the behind the scenes access and the interviews with Coco Gauff that may have made it a richer experience following this story. I'm almost positive that ask was made. And obviously, if we talk to the showrunner or something of the sort, we'll ask that question. But are you on the same page with me? I have to think that they didn't want it.
10,000%. Coco Gauff was there to win in New York. She knew the fame that would come afterwards. And it doesn't make sense because Ben is older than Coco, but Ben is way earlier in his professional career than Coco Gauff is right now. This is him capturing a moment in the spotlight, dare I say, his first real moment in the spotlight, a moment Coco Gauff has had plenty of since she was 14, 15 years old, emerging as a talent in the tennis world. And so couldn't agree with you more. The ask was certainly made. I imagine, again, the ask was reinforced as we approach season three, and perhaps with more planning, it is something Coco Gauff would be more willing to accept and be a part of during the course of a season. But yeah, absolutely. Like, they didn't have Gauff because the reason they didn't have Gauff wasn't because they didn't ask. Absolutely, that offer went out.
Yeah, and if I were to guess, again, this is very speculative, I bet it wasn't Coco's call also, because Coco is someone very online. She loves her shows and her, she has interests outside of tennis. Like, my sense based on her Instagram and her TikTok and all that is that she would absolutely embrace and love being a part of the Netflix show. But I wonder if people around her said, we don't want that.
Yes, And I don't think that she wasn't a part of that decision. Just I want to make that clear. Now, just to in case any listener thinks you're inferring otherwise, I'm
Yeah.
sure Coco said, "I'm not interested in this." And they probably like, "No, you don't want to rush this. Like, you're Coco Gauff. You want this planned out. You want to be able to Instagram and incorporate it into your life and be comfortable doing so, not rush it in what could be the biggest opportunity of your career." And she probably said, "Hey, that's good logic. We'll wait till next season."
Sure. She is a great personality.
Oh,
Like, you
fantastic.
know, just a sense of humor that you're right. We did get to see it a little bit backstage where the cameras were in the training room. One of the best scenes of the entire season, no doubt. I mean,
Elite,
yeah,
elite.
you had all three of them, which is Ben and Francis and Coco, just kind of going back and forth, having fun together in a moment that showcased their personalities in a very authentic, true, and behind the scenes sense. That was fantastic. But I
It was
guess what,
fascinating to see Francis as the older brother, like, because he is
yeah.
significantly older than each of them. And you could tell, like, Ben is the classic, that's how I act with my older brother. Like, again, you could tell even he was trying to get close to him. And, like, you're not going to touch him because you're always a little afraid of him, but you like to be in his face, like almost like a puppy towards the older dog. And then you've got Coco, the little sister, who's just poking both needles and just always in for the jest and in for having fun and steering things along. Like, you're absolutely right. One of the best scenes we had of the season, maybe of the series.
Yeah, Coco was teasing Francis about
Yeah.
his kit, saying Ben's is better. He was,
Yeah.
and then, she was teasing him about the stars that come to his matches, and she was like, "Oh, big foe, I can't believe it." Kind of
Yeah.
like pretending to be starstruck by Francis. And that was a big theme of the episode, is that foe has a celebrity gravitas about him. Coco too, like, and I like that aspect of how the US Open can be portrayed. To me, it really plays for the casual audience where it's like, Kevin Durant is here, Jerry Seinfeld is here, and they can kind of do that whole thing. They didn't have Barack and Michelle, who I think were at Coco's first match at the US Open
Yeah,
last
Tiafoe
year.
certainly inferred as much in talking trashing. Oh, that's it. By the way, talk about all-time comebacks when it's shut up. You have the Obamas at your match, and it's like, oh, that's a good point. I did have the Obamas at my match. Like, that is when you're talking about that is the A-list lifestyle of trash talk. Is that's what you get? Is you had the Obamas. All I had was Kevin Durant.
Do you gain? All right. Well, first, let me wrap up the Coco thing. Here's what we didn't get. We didn't get there was a lot of doubt surrounding Coco after Wimbledon loses first round to Sofia Kenin. The fixation, the hyperfixation on her forehand reached kind of a feverish pitch, and she made some changes in her camp. She brought in Perry Riba, she brought in Brad Gilbert, and it was like this instantaneous tear. She wins her first 500, she wins her first 1000, she wins her first major. It's the summer of Coco. We didn't really, that storyline didn't play out, and I especially was craving, as I said at the end of last the last recap show we did, I was specifically craving the inner workings of the team and Brad Gilbert, who is a mega personality. And I just thought he would, if they were able to get that, I think it would have played really, really well. So that's what we were missing with Coco. Your comments on that before then we can go back to kind of Ben and the men.
Needs to be season three, episode one or two, ideally with her participation, because you're right. It was very superficial, and there was a lot more to the Coco summer to be enjoyed that kind of explains her ascension to stardom and why New York was such a crowning moment for Gauff, given the context of everything. But it's hard to do that when you don't have a player's participation. So that's why that would be the continued assumption. I mean, again, their whole framing of the tennis in this episode, yes, it was framed around one event, the US Open, but they got into the weeds discussing the four American men, discussing Keys, Pegula, Gauff, what they were trying to accomplish on the women's side as well. It speaks to the structuring of episodes in season two. I enjoyed it more than I did season one, and it's why I hope we get that season three so they can follow up like on things like this Gauff storyline.
Yeah, this had some aspects of season one, though, in terms of one location, US
Sure.
Open. trying to get a little bit of a bird's eye view, addressing kind of each and every round in its own way, which was kind of that was not the norm throughout this season. But in this case, it was, yeah, like we're going to paint the story of how a tennis tournament works, which is like, you know, the players win in the quarters and then they lose in the semis and then they go home. And here's what happens on the other side.
But this gets back to the season structure. There's way more meat on the bone for this U.S. Open than last year's, in the sense that last year you got an introduction to Iga for the first time in that U.S. Open episode. You got an introduction really to Frances for the first time in this episode, in that episode. This wasn't the first time we were introduced to the majority of characters in this episode. Yes, no. Shelton, Goff were new, but I think that speaks to the structuring. Like, there was some payoff for an earlier storyline. You got a little bit more depth into what Tommy, Frances, Taylor had all been going through the year. Dare I say, it was much more structured like Drive to Survive. Like, it felt like, okay, give me the update on what McLaren is doing. Give me the update on Ferrari. Oh, we got to go check in on Mercedes and Sabalenka as well, because, by the way, she's competing for world number one here this week. Like, it, how they structured things early gave them the opportunity for something like this. So did the results on court. It was a little bit of a gift, but that speaks to why 100%. I keep emphasizing. I really hope there's a season three and they keep things in this direction, because I like the direction they're going.
Yeah. I mean, they got to go back to Sabalenka without the, hi, I'm Aryna Sabalenka. It's like, no, we already know that. We've established that. And we can kind of, we get some insight on what happened throughout the year, where I do think that she said some things that stuck with me from like a tennis analysis standpoint. I mean, she said at Roland Garros that she lost focus because she was thinking of becoming world number one.
It's always mental.
Yeah. And then it is always mental, but for, again, sometimes it works.
Yeah,
and for Sabalenka, it kind of works, right? She said, I mean, in that US Open final after winning the first set, man, the level just went so steeply downhill. And she said, you know, to Netflix, I started paying too much attention to the crowd and the way Goff was moving. And then we got that really explosive moment in the tunnel where Aryna is breaking rackets and throwing them in the trash can. But then we also get the number one, the world number one trophy ceremony. And for the second season in a row, Sabalenka gets the last moment of the season.
Well, she's a superstar in every episode and every
she's
moment
so good.
That they show
so
her.
Good.
And even with the cameraman, when she's like, oh, you're here, you know, again, I don't love it, but whatever, fuck you. Like, that's just great. That's great television. She's down to have fun with everything she's being asked. She's also down to be extraordinarily candid, to talk about how, you know, we get a lot of the negative side of why the mental strength is so important within tennis. And we finally get a look at the positive side. Aryna Sabalenka saying, look, I want a slam to start this year. Like, it made me believe that I belong, and it has helped me throughout the course of this year play world number one-esque tennis. And now I want to accomplish this next thing. And now I have to get over this next hurdle. And it speaks to the difficulties of life in an individual sport. You think you have this crowning moment in Melbourne, but now it's okay. What can you do next? Because if you don't do it next, you're going to fall right back down the rankings. And you're right to see Sabalenka, even more broadly, the contrast between Sabalenka destroying that racket, and to your point from earlier, the glory Coco Gauff was feeling after winning that moment in that match, in that context, that also perfectly portrays the nature of tennis. There's always going to be a winner on one side who got over the mountaintop and feels this unbelievable accomplishment. And then there's the player who's behind the stage destroying her racket and so furious to have let an opportunity slip, even though she got to the final. It's like, yeah, but I didn't get over that final hump. It was really good television. Not to spoil what we're going to talk about at the end, but I think this was the best episode of the season because they just had so much to work with.
Okay. So let's end on by bringing it back to Ben and the men. I mean, the Tiafoe Shelton match I was at, and it was my favorite match of the US Open, not because
humble brag,
not because the quality was like amazing. you know, or is the best match I've ever seen. There was an electricity to that occasion, Arthur Ashe Night Session quarterfinal to Americans. It was really, really special. Did you gain any insight from Netflix's kind of take on this match that you didn't have when you watched it at home?
Well, I'm glad you bring this match up specifically, because I'm glad from a tennis perspective they covered the fact that Ben was up 6-4 in the tiebreak, that he had two serves on his racket, he double faulted them both, and all of a sudden Francis had a set point. That's a little detail that perhaps other episodes would have just overlooked and given you the more broad picture of a match. And it was also pretty clear that it was, to your point, the cameras came late to Ben Shelton, because you didn't get as much as you would have expected about him and his father. And obviously Brian, a two-time national champion for both, once the men, one for the women at the collegiate level as a coach, leaving his job at Florida to come coach Ben on the pro circuit, Brian being a former professional himself. You didn't get any of that, right? We didn't get a look into why the celebration was hanging up the phone. You feel like that might have been a little fun storyline that in other episodes Netflix might have explored. And, you know, again, what also was funny is Djokovic looming over everything. Djokovic beating Fritz, Djokovic beating Shelton, and you didn't get any of the Djokovic side. Now, he's filming his own stuff always, so you kind of understand why, but still, that was definitely a big part of the narrative in New York. I mean, Ben, his personality just shines through, right? Like, I think he even gives you the quote, "I'm a guy who has a lot of confidence." Like, and that's why I think I can beat the best players, is because he thoroughly believes that's the stage he should be at. Even the insight of, I told Francis 6 months ago, I want to play you in New York. Like, I'm going to play you in New York. That's where it's going to happen. And to Ben's credit, the things he's tried to achieve in tennis, high school level, collegiate level, professional level, he's been able to manifest them. And I do think, even though we didn't get 30 minutes on Ben, we got probably 10 to 15. You kind of feel, I mean, again, I need to tell the listeners, I'm very biased. I know Ben very well. He's on the list of players who, a little less than he used to, but will still respond to my texts because I was there covering him in high school, college, etc. He has that magnetic personality. Like, he's just someone, much like Tommy Paul and all the others, you want to hang out with, right? You want to be around and learn more of. And I think he shined in this episode.
Well, yeah, he's really
That didn't good answer on... your question about the match. I apologize. Yes, I learned more.
Well, I mean, look, he is really good on the mic. When the interviewer says, "What's next for Ben Shelton?" And Shelton goes, "What's next for Ben Shelton is what? Ben Shelton goes back to work."
Yeah,
like, exactly. He just has this almost professional wrestling, or like, you know, UFC fighter who's really talented in the press conferences. He has that kind of vibe where, like, he's going to have a certain swagger with literally just his mouth, which is pretty rare, unique for a tennis player and fun. Yeah, they didn't get into the hang up the phone thing, but we also saw, like, where he gets it from. How about Brian Shelton just gassing him up after the Tommy Paul win? Like, Brian was like, "Dude, you played," I'm paraphrasing here, but he was like, "You were unbelievable out there. You were spectacular. He couldn't touch you." Like, this is the vibe of Brian to Ben after the Tommy Paul match. And honestly, that's a kind of different kind of thing than what we've seen from a lot of coaches after these matches, who maybe don't take that approach with their players. I think, you know, that was an interesting moment there. But also, Shelton talked about, you know, how he loves to be the underdog, trying to take down the big dog. I love the thing about him being like telling Foe that, "I want you in Ashe all year." He was saying that. And yeah, like, he totally stole Tiafoe's thunder in the energy department and the swagger department, which is really what was so, that's what was so vexing and impactful when it came to watching that match, was Francis Tiafoe, who has a great, you know, main character energy. It was just stolen away, and it was all on Ben's side of the court. He was bringing all of the juice in that match. And yeah, it did capture that pretty well.
Well, you said it earlier, in an earlier episode when they were covering Francis, I think it was episode 3, when Arion Broomfield, his girlfriend, told them, bring that swag, right? And what the episode makes pretty clear is it was Ben who brought the swag on that day, just overwhelming him with his weapons, his force of personality, all of these different things. And that's why, again, hopefully the tennis allows Breakpoint to go this direction. You imagine they approached Ben and said, hey, we'd like to follow you during the 2024 season, because I'll tell you what, there's even more meat on the bone there when it comes to Ben's background. He is a testament to people being successful if you grow up feeling loved. Like, his parents are two of the sweetest humans in the world. They have only done it. The only thing they have done is love their children. And like, you can tell in Ben's confidence, how he acts, the respect he brings as well and shows to others, even though he is a fierce competitor. You know, the moment that competition stops, again, seem extraordinarily likable and seems to be well-liked amongst his peers. All this is to say, there is more meat there on the bone. That would be a great storyline as you approach to season 3. And I really just love their, in a general, approach to telling the story of American tennis throughout the course of 2023. Now, obviously, I'm biased as I grew up a fan of American men and women, having grown up in, and live in the States. But they gave you context beyond just, hey, here are some Americans doing well at a few events. It was, no, here's what they're chasing. Here's the progressions that have been throughout the course of their career. And that's why, you know, Francis losing in the quarterfinal 5 years ago, 3 years ago, even, that would have been a tremendous result for Francis. It's just not the standard for him anymore after what he accomplished in 2022 and what he's trying to accomplish moving forward. Same thing for Tommy. Like, round of 16 at the US Open, even 1 year earlier, Tommy would have been celebrating, maybe gone off and partied, enjoyed a few beers. Instead, he leaves demoralized. Like, he said, I think the quote he gave was, this year was a disappointment. And it's like, you just called the best season of your career a disappointment? Really? Like, given everything you accomplished? And obviously, you used some hyperbole for television, but the show introduced the stakes and kind of explained why these athletes might feel the way they do in what would otherwise be, dare I say, deemed a successful event.
Yeah. Well, we debated that on a podcast earlier this year about Tiafoe's season. I agree with Francis. I think that it did feel disappointing in a lot of moments, such as the, and I know I, we're not going to rekindle the debate. You made some very good points, but obviously I'm going to take this opportunity to bring that up and say, see, Francis agrees.
Fair enough.
Okay. So we,
it's also worth noting Ben, like, was ecstatic because it speaks to how early he is in his career. This is a new standard for him being set. To see that contrast, see someone like Goff contrasted with Sabalenka, as I alluded to earlier, she lost in a slam final. You don't get to many of those for most people in your career, and she is destroying a racket. Well done. Good. Well done by the Breakpoint team in displaying that contrast.
Well, yeah, true. Ben wasn't like, crap, I lost in the semis, I lost my chance.
Yeah.
So it is interesting to see different expectations and different reactions to losses at different stages. So let's go to some wrap-up stuff for season number 2. And we'll start with best episode. For me, it was episode 1. I thought that was the strongest because I think Aryna Sabalenka was the strongest character in this season. And I think to kind of go through the Australian Open winning journey with her and the impactful moments that brought and the behind the scenes moment that brought to me was the most rewarding of them all.
Sabalenka was my favorite character probably throughout, but you know how much I detested the Netflix curse bit they were doing in episode 1, or at least the negative aspect of it. I certainly enjoyed Sabalenka's response to it, but I just think episode 6 provided closure to a storyline from the season in a way that no other episode was able to do. And look, again, they were early episodes in a season. Episode 6, or a final episode of any season, is supposed to provide that closure, but it really did. Like, you got the follow-up on, dare I say, the most compelling characters of the season. Certainly season 3, episode 3 would be in the mix for me with how we got to explore the Americans, their continued development, their relationship going back in time. I think episode two with Holger Rune was very revealing in a way about Holger that maybe we just haven't had access to in the past. But I'm going to go six because you got a little Sabalenka, you got the Americans, you got closure in a way that no other episode in maybe this entire season has series has provided.
I also meant to respond to the American thing. Netflix knows what they're doing. So sure. They understand that the US market, they have their data scientists. They understand which markets are most important and what they need to prioritize. I imagine there will be some international viewers of Breakpoint that are like, all right, look, Tommy is really not my focus here. I don't need Taylor Fritz. I think Francis is a little different because he is a bit of a transcendent personality. But I think I just want to acknowledge that I think there might be some pushback in the, among international viewers of like, we don't need the American focus so much. I would just say to that, Netflix knows what they're doing and they're gonna serve the largest audience that they can possibly serve.
You're absolutely right. I also think last year's results made it appropriate for there to be an American-centric storyline in season two. If that's not the case in 2024, I couldn't agree with you more. Go a different direction because there are a lot of other storylines. I'm sure that will emerge.
Yeah, I mean, it probably will, though, because there's such a numbers play with the Americans right now. I mean, We could turn around, there's going to be five in the top 20, and that's completely feasible. So
for sure, I think there could be 20 top 100 American women at the end of the year. Like, that's how deep that group is. But I will be upset with season three if the results don't dictate that and they make that choice again.
All right, next season wrap-up question. Did it get better from season one? You've been very consistent throughout the season saying that you're enjoying yourself more this season. So could you kind of summarize why?
I will rewatch season two. I won't rewatch season one. I just think the storytelling is more compelling. I think you get not just players talking about their background and these dramatic scenic shots and, again, interactions with family members, which at times I love. And we got plenty of that in season two. But I also want to know what's going on in the tennis court. What is this player chasing? What are they aspiring to do? How does it fit into the broader narrative of what's actually going on in the tennis world? And I think they just accomplished that in a far more cohesive way in season two. And again, this gets back to, it wasn't event centric. It was storyline centric. It was the rising stars, Alcaraz and Rune. It was players chasing while the window's still open before the young crop gets better. And Pegula in soccer, you had the Americans, obviously, even the Zverev comeback story, reprehensible character, but you understand how that fit in the broader narrative of what they're trying to talk about the season. The structure was better. I guess that's what it really comes down to. What did you think?
Well, I thought they went in the right direction for the same reason. It was, we're gonna actually be mindful of developing storylines around certain characters instead of we're gonna go to an event, choose a couple characters and see how they do in the event and build a story around that. And as a result, I think the big difference between season one and season two was there were less duds in season two. And I don't mean duds in terms of full episodes. I even mean, I could be talking about a stretch of 8 minutes where it's like this 8 minutes didn't get us anywhere, do anything, wasn't compelling. Like there was less fat. And I think the reason for that is there wasn't as much like, okay, we're just going to do Badosa, Jabeur, Madrid, and let's just do Madrid. And it's like, okay, we learn about Badosa, we learn about Jabeur, maybe we get a little bit behind the scenes in certain moments, but it's like, what's the broader storyline here? And I think because they went with a storyline-centric approach, it was better. Now, they also, with that same storyline-centric approach, shot themselves in the foot because they chose to build a storyline that is at odds with arguably morals and certainly the general temperature or kind of read the room of tennis fans at large, which is that they went with a Zverev sympathetic figure, babyface, Medvedev villain storyline that was totally at odds with, again, how most people feel about those two characters. And it also came across as a PR fluff piece that that kind of put away or shoved aside a very serious matter in regards to the very player that episode was clearly trying to prop up and showcase in a positive manner. And I think that was a massive stain and shadow over this season that was entirely avoidable, which kind of has to come into this question of, was season two better than season one? I think there were much less lows when it comes to, is this compelling? And then there was also this massive mistake.
Yeah, very well said. You understand, again, what were they attempting to do? The one storyline they weren't able to tell in the other five episodes, they needed to come back. They needed someone who was overcoming a clear adversity, something as clear as, I shattered my ankle in a French Open semifinal as a top five player in the world, and I want to get back to that stage, continue the track in my career. And they chose the worst possible character. You talk about misreading the room, misreading the facts. Like, he is not this victim. He is not this portrayal of his story. Like, that is not only not the public perception, that's just not the reality that we live in. And that was certainly the biggest warping of perception and absolutely left a massive stain in the minds of tennis fans, the audience they need to reach more than anyone else. And that's why, as we transition to our biggest wish list towards season three, one of my wishes is for tennis fans, don't give up. Like, hope that the breakpoint, because I think, again, there was clear progress from seasons one to two. They have something to build off of now, characters they can hopefully turn back to. By the way, on the storytelling front, the difference between one and two, they also, like, in season one was admittedly, we had the showrunner on our show, admittedly a little rushed. Like, they didn't have the details worked out. They weren't sure when and where they were going to be able to follow events, and thus when they picked out players, they said, all right, we're going to come to your hometown to make sure we have the footage we need in case the tennis doesn't otherwise provide. They weren't burdened by that in this event. It felt like they had more opportunities to be at events, more opportunities to get players on their own as well. And again, I just, how they're building some of the stories they were able to identify and tell, there's something here to build off of. So that would be one of my first wish as we approach season three, is tennis fans, don't give up on this, because if we give up on it, so will Netflix.
In terms of the wish list, though, for season three, from what Netflix can control, which is, if they're doing a season three, make a great season three, I would say focus on great characters and personalities, and showcase these players. You know, it doesn't need to be top players, and I don't think you necessarily need the contenders of, you know, that are winning the big titles. I just don't. I think you can go for an Alexander Bublik. I think you can go for a Gael Monfils and Elena Svitolina, and look at that dynamic and that family life. Or what about a Caroline Wozniacki and, you know, balancing motherhood and professional tennis? Like, I go for characters and storylines. It doesn't always have to be this person is trying to win a slam. So that's one for me. But also, you know, you need to rebuild your credibility, I think, after the Zverev thing. And there's only one way to do that, which is cover difficult topics, or a difficult topic or two. Do it with honesty. Do it well, in a way that doesn't come across as public relations for the tours or a particular player. Now, this is not Netflix's forte. Like, Drive to Survive, I don't think that, you know, that's how they have made their mark, by being something like, you know, 60 Minutes or Real Sports, right? It's like, that's not what they do. But when you go so far in the other direction, whereas to kind of damage your credibility, there's only one way to get it back, which is, let's say there's this interesting, you know, Saudi Arabia storyline in 2024. Cover it with honesty. Cover it with nuance and realness. Let's say there's, you know, I don't know, something like the Simona Halep doping thing, something like that. Cover a tough topic You know what I mean?
The PTPA, the ATP now offering guaranteed salaries for players. Why is that important? How does that factor into tennis's future? I couldn't agree with you more. And that was one of my things on the wish list. Be less conflict averse. Yes, F1, you're right, doesn't get intrusive. But when Mercedes and Red Bull are going at it, that becomes a central theme of multiple episodes and something they explore when there are penalty violations or controversy over a call from the booth, whatever it may be. And that certainly exists throughout the course of a tennis calendar and the course of the 11 months. Now, they tried that with Zverev Medvedev. And again, they picked the wrong character to portray a conflict of that nature. But yeah, less conflict averse because plenty of them exist. Excuse me. And if you cover them with honesty, I think it's something tennis fans and sports fans, fans of shows like this more broadly, are going to enjoy. Excuse me, I'm caught with the hiccups here. I would also incorporate maybe two more episodes per season, just so that you can have more follow-ups the way we did in season 6. And maybe it's not two more episodes. Maybe it's one more episode, because what else happened for Pegula and Sakkari? Or maybe, to your point, there's another version of them at a lower level. Someone like an Arthur Fee comes to mind, someone like a Jung Chin Wen, two more young stars who had these magnificent results to end their seasons and are now potential breakthrough stars.
Personalities, though. Like, this is what I would, this is what I would say.
In photo shoots.
No, that doesn't tell me anything. I'm not saying she's not a good personality. I'm just saying that should be the determining factor. Because sure, you can look at Tennis Abstract and be like, this person is an intriguing storyline in tennis. For me, the priority needs to be find the personalities, and that is going to make the most compelling episodes. You can disagree with me. Like, I think there's an argument to be made that, well, maybe we should be just hunting, you know, the best tennis stories, and that the rest will take care of itself. But I don't know, like, what's the deal with Hugo Gaston? Like, how can this dude take 5 unsportsmanlike fines like in a span of 5 months? What the hell is going on with the guy? I don't know. Like, I wouldn't mind. Netflix is not going to do that, okay? But I'm just saying, for me, it doesn't need to be this is a significant tennis story because they are on the rise or they are winning titles. Give me interesting characters.
Episode 4 next season is an investigative documentary into doping and tennis, or into, I mean, talk about a great storyline. Anyone who read, I think it was the Washington Post piece on gambling and tennis and players throwing matches on the lower level. Like, I would be all in for an episode like that. Of course I do. I think this gets back to the first point. I don't disagree with you. I agree. Like, less conflict averse, chase that narrative, because those things are there in tennis to be enjoyed beyond just what's happening at the top of the game. And in order to recreate the success of season 2, yeah, you're going to need some compelling storylines to follow, but you're absolutely right. Personalities, conflict. Like, those are the two things people are looking for in every show they watch, and those exist within tennis if Breakpoint producers want to look for them.
We don't know exactly what the next batch of episodes are going to look like, when it is, what we're going to be doing for it, but we will certainly be having a conversation about Breakpoint in about, what, four-ish months from now, if they do like anything like the last season where they'll release around Roland Garros times. So looking forward to that, Gruskin. Been a pleasure talking through every episode with you to start season 2. This has been season 2, episode 6, Becoming the One, on the Breakpoint Recap Show, Gil Gross YouTube, Crack Rackets Podcast Network.